Chapter 5. The Grey King. 1.
You seem to be spending a great deal of our money very quickly, Lucas, said Doña Sofia Salvara.
Circumstance has blessed us, Doña Sofia. Locke gave a smile that was a measure of great triumph by Fairwhite standards, a tight-lipped little thing that might have been a grimace of pain from anyone else. Everything is proceeding with the most agreeable speed. Ships and men and cargo, and soon all we'll need to do is pack your wardrobe for a short voyage.
Indeed, indeed.
Were those dark circles under her eyes? Was there the slightest hint of wariness in her attitude toward him? She certainly wasn't at ease. Locke made a mental note to avoid pushing her too far, too fast. It was a delicate dance, playing straight lines and smiles with someone who knew he was a mummer but didn't know that he knew she knew. With the slightest sigh, Doña Sofia pressed her personal sigil down into the warm blue wax at the bottom of the parchment she was contemplating. She added a few flowing lines of ink above the seal, her signature in the curving Therin script that had become something of a fad among literate nobles in the past few years.
If you say you require another 4,000 today, another 4,000 it must be.
I am most sincerely grateful, my lady.
Well, you'll certainly pay for it soon enough, she said. Many times over, if our hopes play out.
At that she smiled, with genuine good humour that crinkled the edges of her eyes, and held out the fresh promissory note. Oho, thought Locke, much better. The more in control the Mark thinks they are, the more easily they respond to real control. Another one of Father Chain's old maxims, proven in Locke's experience too many times to count. Please give my warmest regards to your husband when he returns from his business in the city, my lady, said Locke, taking the wax-sealed parchment in hand. Now, I fear, I must go see some men about payments that will not appear on any official ledger.
Of course, I quite understand. Conte can show you out.
The gruff, weathered man-at-arms was paler than usual, and it seemed to Locke that there was a slight but obvious hitch in his stride. Yes, the poor fellow was clearly favouring a certain badly bruised portion of his anatomy. Locke's stomach turned in unconscious sympathy at his own memory of that night.
I say, Conte, he began politely, are you feeling quite well? You seem, forgive me for saying so, troubled this past day or two.
I'm well for the most part, Master Fairwhite.
There was a slight hardening of the lines at the edges of the man's mouth.
Perhaps a bit under the weather.
Nothing serious.
A minor ague, perhaps. They happen this time of year.
Ah, one of the tricks of your climate. I've not yet felt such a thing myself.
Well, said Conte, with an absolute lack of expression on his face. Mind yourself then, Master Fairwhite. Camor can be a very dangerous place in the most unlooked-for ways.
Oh, ho, ho, Locke thought. So they'd let him in on the secret as well. And the man had a proud streak, at least as wide as Sophia's, to drop even the slightest hint of a threat. Worth noting that.
I'm the very soul of caution, my dear Conte.
Locke tucked the promissory note within his black waistcoat and adjusted his cascading cravats as they approached the front door of the Salvara Manor.
I keep my chambers very well illuminated to ward off miasmas, and I wear copper rings after false light. Just the thing for your hot and cold fevers. I would wager that a few days at sea will put you right.
No doubt, said Conte. The voyage. I do look forward to the voyage.
Then we are of one mind.
Locke waited for the Don's man to open the wide glass and iron door for him, and as he stepped out into the moist air of false light, he nodded stiffly but affably.
I shall pray for your health tomorrow, my good fellow.
Too kind, Master Fairwhite.
The ex-soldier had set one hand on the hilt of one of his knives, perhaps unconsciously.
I shall most assuredly offer prayers concerning yours.
Locke began walking south at a leisurely pace, crossing from the Isla Durona to Two Silver Green as he and Carlo had just a few nights previously. The hangman's wind was stronger than usual, and as he walked through the park in the washed-out light of the city's glowing elderglass, the hiss and rustle of leaves was like the sighing of vast creatures hiding in the greenery all around him. Just under 17,000 crowns in half a week. The Don Salvara game was well ahead of their original plans, which had called for a 2-week span between first touch and final blow-off. Locke was certain he could get one more touch out of the Don in perfect safety, push the total up over 22 or maybe 23,000, and then pull a vanish. Go to ground, take it easy for a few weeks, stay alert and let the Grey King mess sort itself out. And then, as a bonus miracle, somehow convince Kappa Barsavi to disengage him from Nazca, and do so without twisting the old man's breeches. Locke sighed. When false light died and true night fell, the glow never seemed to simply fade so much as recede, as though it were being drawn back within the glass, alone reclaimed by a jealous creditor. Shadows widened and blackened until finally the whole park was swallowed by them from below. Emerald lanterns flickered to life here and there in the trees, their light soft and eerie and strangely relaxing. They offered just enough illumination to see the crushed stone paths that wound their way through the walls of trees and hedges. Locke felt as though the spring of tension within him was unwinding itself ever so slightly. He listened to the muted crunch of his own footsteps on gravel, and for a few moments he was surprised to find himself possessed by something perilously close to contentment. He was alive. He was rich. He had made the decision not to skulk and cringe from the troubles that gnawed at his gentleman bastards. And for one brief moment, in the middle of 88,000 people and all the heaving, stinking, ever-flowing noise and commerce and machinery of their city, he was alone with the gently swaying trees of Two Silver Green. Alone. The hairs on the back of his neck stood up, and the old cold fear, the constant companion of anyone raised on the streets, was suddenly alive within him. It was a summer night in Two Silver Green, the safest open park in the city, patrolled at any given time by 2 or 3 squads of yellow jackets with their night lanterns waving on poles, filled, sometimes to the point of comedy, with the strolling sons and daughters of the wealthy classes, holding hands and swatting insects and seeking the privacy of nooks and shadows. Locke gazed quickly up and down the curving paths around him. He was truly alone. There was no sound in the park but for the sighing of the leaves and the buzzing of the insects. No voices or footsteps that he could hear. He twisted his right forearm, and a thin stiletto of blackened steel fell from his coat sleeve into his palm, pommel down. He carried it straight against his arm, rendering it invisible from any distance, and hurried toward the southern gate of the park. A mist was rising, seeping up as though the grass were pouring grey vapours into the night. Locke shivered despite the warm, heavy air. A mist was perfectly natural, wasn't it? The whole city was blanketed in the stuff 2 nights out of 3. A man could lose track of the end of his own nose in it sometimes, but why? The southern gate of the park. He was standing before the southern gate of the park, staring out across an empty cobbled lane at a mist-shrouded bridge. That bridge was the Eldrin Arch, its red lanterns soft and ominous in the fog. The Eldrin Arch leading north to the Isla Durona. He'd gotten turned around. How was that possible? His heart was beating so fast, and then, Doña Sofia, that cunning bitch. She'd done something to him, slipped him some alchemical mischief on the parchment. The ink? The wax?
Was it a poison, drawing some cloud around his senses before it did its work? Was it some other drug, intended to make him ill? Petty, perfectly deniable revenge to sate her for the time being? He fumbled for the parchment, missing his inner coat pocket, aware that he was moving a bit too slowly and clumsily for the confusion to be entirely in his imagination. There were men moving under the trees. One to his left, another to his right. The Eldrin Arch was gone. He was back at the heart of the curving paths, staring out into a darkness cut only by the emerald light of the lanterns. He gasped, crouched, brought up the stiletto, head swimming. The men were cloaked. They were on either side. There was the sound of footsteps on gravel, not his own. The dark shape of crossbows, the backlit shapes of the men. His head whirled.
"Master Thorne," said a man's voice, muffled and distant. "We require an hour of your attention."
"Crooked Warden!" Locke gasped, and then even the faint colours of the trees seemed to drain from his vision, and the whole night went black. 3. When he came to, he was already sitting up. It was a curious sensation. He'd awoken before from blackness brought on by injuries and by drugs, but this was different. It was as though someone had simply set the mechanisms of his consciousness moving again, like a scholar opening the spigot on a Ferrari water clock. He was in the common room of a tavern, seated on a chair at a table by himself. He could see the bar and the hearth and the other tables, but the place was dank and empty, smelling of mould and dust. A flickering orange light came from behind him, an oil lantern. The windows were greasy and misted over, turning the light back upon itself. He couldn't see anything of the outside through them.
"There's a crossbow at your back," said a voice just a few feet behind him.
A pleasantly cultured man's voice, definitely Komori, but somewhat off in a few of the pronunciations. A native who'd spent time elsewhere? The voice was entirely unknown to him.
"Master Thorne."
Icicles seemed to grow in Locke's spine. He racked his brains furiously for recall of those last few seconds in the park. Hadn't one of the men there called him that as well? He gulped.
"Why do you call me that? My name is Lucas Fairwhite. I'm a citizen of Emberlane, working for the House of Bel-Oster." "I could believe that, Master Thorne. Your accent is convincing, and your willingness to suffer that black wool is nothing short of heroic. Don Lorenzo and Doña Sofia certainly believed in Lucas Fairwhite, until you yourself disabused them of the notion."
"It isn't Barsavi," Locke thought desperately. "It couldn't be Barsavi. Barsavi would be conducting this conversation himself, if he knew. He would be conducting it at the heart of the floating grave, with every gentleman bastard tied to a post and every knife in Sage Kindness bag sharpened and gleaming.
"My name is Lucas Fairwhite," Locke insisted. "I don't understand what you want or what I'm doing here. Have you done anything to Grauman? Is he safe?"
"Jean Tannen is perfectly safe," said the man, "as you well know. How I would have loved to see it up close when you strolled into Don Salvara's office with that silly sigil wallet under your black cloak, destroying his confidence in Lucas Fairwhite, just as a father gently tells his children there's really no such thing as the Blessed Bringer. You're an artist, Master Thorne."
"I've already told you my name is Lucas, Lucas Fairwhite, and..."
"If you tell me that your name is Lucas Fairwhite one more time, I'm going to put a bolt through the back of your upper left arm. I wouldn't mean to kill you just to complicate your life. A nice big hole, maybe a broken bone. Ruin that fine suit of yours, perhaps get blood all over that lovely parchment. Wouldn't the clerks at Maraggio's love to hear an explanation for that? Promissory notes are so much more attention-getting when they're covered in gore."
Locke said nothing for quite a long while.
Now that won't do either, Locke. Surely you must have realized I can't be one of Barsavi's men.
13, Locke thought. Where the hell did I make a mistake? If the man was speaking truthfully, if he didn't work for Kappa Barsavi, there was only one other possibility. The real spider. The real Midnighters. Had Locke's use of the pretend sigil wallet been reported? Had that counterfeiter in Talisham decided to try for a bit of extra profit by dropping a word with the Duke's secret constables? It seemed the likeliest explanation.
Turn around. Slowly.
Locke stood up and did so, and bit his tongue to avoid crying out in surprise. The man seated at the table before him could have been anywhere between 30 and 50. He was lean and rangy and grey at the temples. The mark of Camor was upon his face. He bore the sun-darkened olive skin, the high temples and cheekbones, the sharp nose. He wore a grey leather doublet over a grey silk tunic. His cloak and mantle were grey, as was the hood that was swept back behind his head. His hands, folded neatly before him, were covered with thin grey swordsman's gloves, kid leather that was weathered and creased with use. The man had hunter's eyes, cold and steady and measuring. The orange light of the lantern was reflected in their dark pupils. For a second it seemed to Locke that he was seeing not a reflection but a revelation, that the dark fire burned behind the man's eyes. Locke shivered despite himself. All that grey.
You,
he whispered, dropping the accent of Lucas Fairwhite.
None other, said the Grey King. I disdain these clothes as something of a theatrical touch, but it's a necessary one. Of all the men in Camor, surely you understand these things, Master Thorne.
I have no idea why you keep calling me that, said Locke, shifting his footing as unobtrusively as he could, feeling the comforting weight of his second stiletto in the other sleeve of his coat.
And I don't see this crossbow you mentioned. I said it was at your back.
The Grey King gestured at the far wall with a thin, bemused smile. Warily, Locke turned his head. There was a man standing against the wall of the tavern, standing right in the spot Locke had been staring at until the previous moment. A cloaked and hooded man, broad-shouldered, leaning lazily against the wall with a loaded alley piece in the crook of his arm, the quarrel pointed casually at Locke's chest. Locke turned back, but the Grey King was no longer seated at the table. He was standing a dozen feet away, to Locke's left, behind the disused bar. The lantern on the table hadn't moved, and Locke could see that the man was grinning.
This isn't possible.
Of course it is, Master Thorne. Think it through. The number of possibilities is actually vanishingly small.
The Grey King waved his left hand in an arc, as though wiping a window. Locke glanced back at the wall and saw that the crossbowman had disappeared once again.
Well, fuck me, said Locke. You're a bondsmage.
No, said the Grey King. I'm a man without that advantage. No different than yourself. But I employ a bondsmage.
He pointed to the table where he'd previously been sitting. There, without any sudden movement or jump in Locke's perception, sat a slender man, surely not yet out of his 20s. His chin and cheeks were peach-fuzzed, and his hairline was already in rapid retreat to the back of his head. His eyes were alight with amusement, and Locke immediately saw in him the sort of casual presumption of authority that most congenital blue bloods wore like a second skin. He was dressed in an extremely well-tailored grey coat with flaring red silk cuffs. The bare skin of his left wrist bore 3 tattooed black lines. On his right hand was a heavy leather gauntlet, and perched atop this, staring at Locke as though he were nothing more than a field mouse with delusions of grandeur, was the fiercest hunting hawk Locke had ever seen. The bird of prey stared directly at him, its eyes pinpoints of black within gold on either side of a curved beak that looked dagger sharp. Its brown and grey wings were folded back sleekly, and its talons... What was wrong with its talons? Its rear claws were huge, distended, oddly lengthened.
"My associate, the falconer," said the Grey King, "a bondsmage of Carthane, my bondsmage, the key to a great many things. And now that we've been introduced, let us speak of what I expect you to do for me."
4. "They are not to be fucked with," Chains had told him once, many years before.
"Why not?"
Locke was 12 or 13 at the time, about as cocksure as he'd ever been in life, which was saying something.
"I see you've been neglecting your history again. I'll assign you more reading shortly."
Chains sighed.
"The Bonds Magi of Carthane are the only sorcerers on the continent because they permit no one else to study their art. Outsiders they find must join them or be slain."
"And none resist? Nobody fights back or hides from them?"
"Of course they do, here and there. But what can 2 or 5 or 10 sorcerers in hiding do against 400 with a city-state at their command? What the Bonds Magi do to outsiders and renegades, they make Kappa Barsavi look like a priest of Perelandro. They are utterly jealous, utterly ruthless, and utterly without competition. They have achieved their desired monopoly. No one will shelter sorcerers against the will of the Bonds Magi. No one. Not even the King of the Seven Marrows."
"Curious," said Locke, "that they would still call themselves Bonds Magi then."
"It's false modesty. I think it amuses them. They set such ridiculous prices for their services, it's less like mercenary work to them and more like a cruel joke at the expense of their clients."
"Ridiculous prices?"
"A novice would cost you 500 crowns a day. A more experienced spellbinder might cost you 1,000. They mark their rank with tattoos around their wrists. The more black circles you see, the more polite you become."
1,000 crowns a day?
"You see now why they're not everywhere, on retainer to every court and noble and pissant warlord with a treasury to waste. Even in times of war and other extreme crises, they can be secured for a very limited duration. When you do cross paths with one, you can be sure that the client is paying them for serious, active work."
"Where did they come from?"
"Carthane."
"Ha ha! I mean their guild, their monopoly."
"That's easy. One night a powerful sorcerer knocks on the door of a less powerful sorcerer. 'I'm starting an exclusive guild,' he says. 'Join me now or I'll blast you out of your fucking boots right where you stand.' So naturally the second mage says,
'You know, I've always wanted to join a guild.'
Right. Those two go bother a third sorcerer. 'Join the guild,' they say, 'or fight both of us, 2-on-1, right here and right now.' Repeat as necessary until 300 or 400 guild members are knocking on the door of the last independent mage around, and everyone who said no is dead."
"They must have weaknesses," said Locke.
"Of course they've got weaknesses, boy. They're mortal men and women, same as us. They eat, they shit, they age, they die. But they're like God's damned hornets. Mess with one and the rest show up to punch you full of holes. 13 help anyone who kills a bondsmage, purposely or otherwise."
"Why?"
"It's the oldest rule of their guild. A rule without exceptions.
Kill a bonds mage and the whole guild drops whatever it's doing to come after you. They seek you out by any means they need to use. They kill your friends, your family, your associates. They burn your home. They destroy everything you've ever built. Before they finally let you die, they make sure you know that your line has been wiped from the earth, root and branch.
So nobody's allowed to oppose them at all?
Oh, you can oppose them all right. You can try to fight back, for what it's worth when one of them is against you. But if you go as far as killing one, well, it's just not worth it. Suicide would be preferable. At least then they won't kill everyone you ever loved or befriended.
Wow.
Yes. Chains shook his head. Sorcery's impressive enough, but it's their fucking attitude that makes them such a pain. And that's why, when you find yourself face to face with one, you bow and scrape and mind your sirs and madams.
5.
Nice bird, arsehole, said Locke.
The bondsmage stared coldly at him, nonplussed.
So you must be the reason nobody can find your boss. The reason none of the Full Crowns could remember what they were doing when Tall Tesso got nailed to a wall.
The falcon screeched, and Locke flinched backward. The creature's anger was extremely expressive. It was more than the cry of an agitated animal. It was somehow personal. Locke raised his eyebrows.
My familiar mislikes your tone of voice, said the falconer. I, for one, have always found her judgment to be impeccable. I would mind your tongue.
Your boss expects me to do something for him, said Locke, which means I have to remain functional. Which means the manner in which I address his fucking Carthani lackeys is immaterial. Some of the garistas you killed were friends of mine. I'm looking at an arranged fucking marriage because of you, so eat hemp and shit rope, bondsmage. The falcon exploded, screeching, from its perch on its master's hand. Locke raised his left arm in front of his face and the bird slammed against it, talons clutching with edges that sliced through the fabric of Locke's coat sleeve. The bird fastened itself on Locke's arm excruciatingly and beat its wings to steady itself. Locke hollered and raised his right hand to punch the bird.
"Do that," said the falconer, "and die. Look closely at my familiar's talons."
Biting the insides of his cheeks against the pain, Locke did just that. The creature's rear talons weren't talons at all, but more like smooth, curved hooks that narrowed to needle points at their tips. There were strange, pulsating sacs on the legs just above them, and even to Locke's limited knowledge of hunting birds, this seemed very wrong.
"Vestris," said the Grey King, "is a scorpion hawk, a hybrid, facilitated by alchemy and sorcery. One of many that the Bonds Magi amuse themselves with. She carries not just talons, but a sting. If she were to cease being tolerant of you, you might make it 10 steps before you fell dead in your tracks."
Blood began to drip from Locke's arm. He groaned. The bird snapped at him with its beak, clearly enjoying itself.
"Now," said the Grey King, "are we not all grown men and birds here? Functional is such a relative state of affairs, Locke. I would hate to have to give you another demonstration of just how relative."
"I apologize," said Locke between gritted teeth. "Vestris is a fine and persuasive little bird." The falconer said nothing, but Vestris released her grip on Locke's left arm, unleashing new spikes of pain. Locke clutched his bloodied wool sleeve, massaging the wounds within it. Vestris fluttered back to her perch on her master's glove and resumed staring at Locke.
"Isn't it just as I said, falconer?"
The Grey King beamed at Locke.
"Our Thorn knows how to recover his equilibrium. 2 minutes ago, he was too scared to think.
Now he's already insulting us and no doubt scheming for a way out of this situation.
I don't understand, said Locke, why you keep calling me Thorn.
Of course you do, said the Grey King. I'm only going to go over this once, Locke. I know about your little burrow beneath the House of Perelandro, your vault, your fortune. I know you don't spend any of your nights sneak thieving, as you claim to all the other right people. I know you breach the secret peace to spring elaborate confidence schemes on nobles who don't know any better, and I know you're good at it. I know you didn't start these ridiculous rumors about the Thorn of Camor, but you and I both know they refer to your exploits indirectly. Lastly, I understand that Kappa Barsavi would do some very interesting things to you and all of your gentlemen bastards if the things I know were to be confided to him.
Oh, please, said Locke. You're not exactly in any position to whisper politely in his ear and be taken seriously.
I'm not the one who would be whispering in his ear, said the Grey King, smiling. If you failed at the task I have for you, I have others close to him to speak for me. I trust I have made myself very clear.
Locke glared for a few seconds, then sat down with a sigh, turning his chair around and leaning his injured arm against the back.
I see your point. And in exchange?
In exchange for the task I require, I would promise you that Kappa Barsavi won't hear about your very cleverly arranged double life, nor that of your closest companions.
So, said Locke slowly, that's how it is.
My bondsmage accepted, I'm a thrifty man, Locke.
The Grey King stepped out from behind the bar and folded his arms.
You get paid in life, not coin.
What's the task?
A straightforward beguilement, said the Grey King. I want you to become me.
I don't understand.
The time has come for me to quit this game of shadows. Barsavi and I need to speak face to face. I will very shortly arrange a clandestine conference with the Kappa, one that will bring him forth from the floating grave.
Fat chance.
In this you must trust me. I'm the architect of his current troubles. I assure you, I know what can bring him out from that soggy fortress of his, but it won't be me that he'll speak to. It will be you. The Thorn of Camor, the greatest mummer this city has ever produced. You cast in the role of me, just for one night, a virtuoso performance.
A command performance? Why?
I will be required elsewhere at that time. The conference is one part of a wider concern.
I am personally known to Kappa Barsavi and his entire family.
You have already convinced the Salvaras that you were two different men. In the same day, no less. I'll coach you in what I wish you to say, and provide you with a suitable wardrobe. Between your skills and my current anonymity, no one will ever be aware that you are even involved, or that you are not the real Grey King.
An amusing plan. It has balls, and that appeals to me. But you do realize that I'm going to look like quite the ass, said Locke, when the Kappa opens our conversation with a dozen crossbow bolts to my chest.
Hardly an issue. You'll be quite well protected against routine foolishness on the Kappa's part. I'll be sending the Falconer with you.
Locke flicked his gaze back to the bondsmage, who smiled with obvious mock magnanimity.
"Do you really think," continued the Grey King,
that I would have let you keep that other stiletto in your coat sleeve if any weapon in your hands could touch me. Try to cut me. I'll let you borrow a crossbow or two if you like. A quarrel will do no better. The same protection will be yours when you meet with the copper.
Then it's true, said Locke. Those stories aren't just stories. Your pet mage gives you more than just the ability to make my brain lock up like I've been drinking all night.
Yes, and it was my men who started spreading those stories for one purpose. I wanted Barsavi's gangs to so dread my presence that they wouldn't dare to get close to you when the time came for you to speak to him. After all, I have the power to kill men with a touch.
The Grey King smiled.
And when you're me, so will you.
Locke frowned. That smile, that face, there was something damned familiar about the Grey King. Nothing immediately obvious, just a nagging sensation that Locke had been in his presence before. He cleared his throat.
That's very thoughtful of you. And what happens when I've finished this task for you?
A parting of the ways, said the Grey King. You to your business and me to my own.
I find that somewhat difficult to believe.
You'll leave your meeting with Barsavi alive, Locke. Fear not for what happens after that. I assure you it won't be as bad as you think. If I merely wanted to assassinate him, can you deny that I could have done it long ago?
You've killed 7 of his garistas. You've kept him locked away on the floating grave for months.
Not as bad as I think. He killed 8 of his own full crowns after Tesso died. He won't accept less than blood from you.
Barsavi has kept himself locked away on the floating grave, Locke. And as I said, you must trust me to deal with that end of the situation. The copper will acquiesce to what I have to offer him. We'll settle the question of Camor once and for all, to everyone's satisfaction.
I grant that you're dangerous, said Locke, but you must be mad.
Suit whatever meaning you wish to my actions, Locke, provided that you perform as required.
It would appear, Locke said sourly, that I have no choice.
This is no accident. Are we agreed? You'll perform this task for me?
With instruction in what you wish me to say to Kappa Barsavi?
Yes. There will be one other condition.
Really? If I'm going to do this for you, said Locke, I need to have a way to speak to you. Or at least get a message to you at my own will. Something may come up which can't wait for you to prance around appearing out of nowhere.
It's unlikely, said the Grey King.
It's a necessity. Do you want me to be successful in this task or not?
Very well, the Grey King nodded. Falconer.
The Falconer rose from his seat. Vestris never took her eyes from Locke's. The hawk's master reached inside his coat with his free hand and withdrew a candle, a tiny cylinder of white wax with an odd smear of crimson swirling through it.
"Light this," said the bondsmage, "in a place of solitude. You must be absolutely alone. Speak my name, and I will hear and come soon enough."
"Thank you."
Locke took the candle with his right hand and slipped it into his own coat. Falconer. Easy to remember, that.
Vestris opened her beak, but made no noise. It snapped shut and the bird blinked. A yawn? Her version of a chuckle at Locke's expense?
"I'll be keeping an eye on you," said the bondsmage. "Just as Vestris feels what I feel, I see what she sees."
"That explains quite a bit," said Locke.
"If we are agreed," said the Grey King, "our business here is finished. I have something else to do, and it must be done tonight. Thank you, Master Thorn, for seeing reason."
said the man with the crossbow to the man with the money purse. Locke stood up and slipped his left hand into a coat pocket. The forearm was still throbbing with pain. So when is this meeting supposed to take place?
3 nights hence, said the Grey King. No interruption at all for your Don Salvara game, I trust.
I don't think you really care, but no.
All for the better, then. Let us return you to your own affairs.
You're not going to...
But it was too late. The falconer had already begun to gesture with his free hand and move his lips, forming words but not quite vocalizing them. The room spun. The orange lantern light became a fading streak of color against the darkness of the room, and then there was only darkness. 6.
When Locke's senses returned, he found himself standing on the bridge between the snare and Coin Kisser's Row. Not a moment had passed by his own personal reckoning, but when he looked up, he saw that the clouds were gone. The stars had whirled in the dark sky, and the moons were low in the west.
Son of a bitch, he hissed. It's been hours. Jean's going to be having fits.
He thought quickly. Carlo and Galdo had planned to spend the evening making their rounds in the snare, with Bug in tow. They would probably have ended up at the last mistake, dicing and drinking and trying not to get thrown out for card sharping. Jean had intended to spend the night feigning occupancy in the broken tower rooms, at least until Locke returned. That would be the closest place to begin hunting for them. Just then, Locke remembered that he was still dressed as Lucas Fairwhite. He slapped his forehead. He pulled his coat and cravats off, yanked the false optics from the bridge of his nose, and stuffed them in a vest pocket. He gingerly felt the cuts on his left arm. They were deep and still painful, but the blood had crusted on them, so at least he wasn't dripping all over the place. God's damn the Grey King, thought Locke, and God's grant I get the chance to balance this night out in the ledger. He ruffled his hair, unbuttoned his vest, untucked his shirt, and reached down to fold and conceal the ridiculous ribbon tongues of his shoes. His cravats and his decorative belts went into the coat, which Locke then folded up and tied by the sleeves. In the darkness, it bore an excellent resemblance to a plain old cloth sack. With the outward flourishes of Lucas Fairwhite broken down, he could at least pass without notice for a reasonably short period of time. Satisfied, he turned and began to walk quickly down the south side of the bridge, toward the still lively lights and noises of the snare. Jean Tannen actually appeared from an alley and took him by the arm as he turned onto the street on the north side of the broken tower, where the main entrance to the last mistake opened onto the cobbles.
Locke, where the hell have you been all night? Are you well?
Jean, gods, am I ever glad to see you? I'm far from well, as are you. Where are the others?
When you didn't return, Jean said, speaking in a low voice close to Locke's ear. I found them in the last mistake and sent them up to our rooms with Bug. I've been pacing the alleys down here, trying to keep out of sight. I didn't want us all getting scattered across the city by night. We feared...
I was taken, Jean, but then I was let go. Let's get up to the rooms. We have a new problem, fresh from the oven and hot as hell.
7. They let the windows in their rooms stay open this time, with thin sheets of translucent mesh drawn down to keep out biting insects. The sky was turning grey, with lines of red visible just beneath the eastern windowsills, when Locke finished relating the events of the night. His listeners had shadows beneath their bleary eyes, but none showed any indication of sleepiness just then.
"At least we know now," Locke finished, "that he won't be trying to kill me like he did the other Garistas."
"Not until 3 nights hence, anyway," said Galdo.
"Bastards simply can't be trusted," said Bug.
"But for the time being," said Locke, "he must be obeyed."
Locke had changed into spare clothes. He now looked much more suitably low class. Jean had insisted on washing his arm with reinforced wine heated to near boiling on an alchemical hearthstone. Locke now had a compress of brandy-soaked cloth pressed to it,
and he bathed it in the light of a small white glow globe. It was common knowledge among the physicers of Camor that light drove back malodorous air and helped prevent lingering infections.
Must he? Carlo scratched a stubbly chin. How far do you figure we can get if we run like hell?
From the Grey King? Who knows? Locke sighed. From the Bondsmage, not far enough, ever.
So we just sit back, said Jean, and let him pull your strings like a marionette on stage.
I was rather taken, said Locke, with the whole idea of him not telling Kappa Barsavi about our confidence games, yes. This whole thing is mad, said Galdo. You said you saw three rings on this falconer's wrist?
The one that didn't have the damn scorpion hawk, yeah.
Three rings, Jean muttered. It is mad. To keep one of those people in service. It must be 2 months now since the first stories of the Grey King appeared, since the first Garista got it. Who was it again?
Gil the Cutter from the Rumhounds, said Carlo.
The coin involved has to be ludicrous. I doubt the Duke could keep a bondsmage of rank on for this long. So who the fuck is this Grey King, and how is he paying for this?
Immaterial, said Locke. 3 nights hence, or 2.5 now that the sun's coming up, there'll be 2 Grey Kings, and I'll be one of them.
13, said Jean. He put his head in his hands and rubbed his eyes with his palms.
So that's the bad news. Kappa Barsavi wants me to marry his daughter, and now the Grey King wants me to impersonate him at a secret meeting with Kappa Barsavi.
Locke grinned.
The good news is I didn't get any blood on that new promissory note for 4,000 crowns.
I'll kill him, said Bug. Get me poisoned quarrels and an alley piece, and I'll drill him in the eyes.
Bug, said Locke, that makes leaping off a temple roof sound reasonable by comparison.
But who would ever expect it?
Bug, sitting beneath one of the room's eastern windows, turned his head to stare out it for a few moments, as he had been intermittently doing all night.
Look, everyone knows that one of you four could kill them, but nobody would expect me. Total surprise. One shot in the face, no more Grey King.
Assuming the falconer allowed your crossbow bolts to hit his client, said Locke, he would probably cook us where we stood right after that. Also, I very much doubt that fucking bird is going to be fluttering around this tower where we can see it.
You never know, said Bug. I think I saw it before, when we made first touch on Don Salvara.
I'm pretty sure I did, too.
Carlo was knuckle-walking a Solon on his left hand without looking at it.
While I was strangling you, Locke, something flew overhead. Damn big and fast for a wren or a sparrow.
So, said Jean, he really has been watching us, and he really knows all there is to know about us. Knuckling under might be wiser for the time being, but we've got to have some contingencies we can cook up.
Should we call off the Don Salvara game now?
Asked Bug meekly.
No.
Locke shook his head vigorously. There's absolutely no reason for the time being.
How, said Galdo, do you figure that?
The reason we discussed shortening the game was to keep our heads down and try to avoid getting killed by the Grey King. Now we can be pretty damn sure that won't happen, at least not for 3 days. So the Salvara game stays in play.
For 3 days, yes, until the Grey King has no further use for you.
Jean spat. Next step in whatever the plans are. Thanks for your cooperation. Here's a complimentary knife in the back for all of you.
It's a possibility, said Locke. So what we do is this. Jean, you scuttle around today after you've had some sleep. Cancel those arrangements for sea travel. If we need to run, waiting for a ship to put out will take too long. Likewise, drop more gold at the Viscount's gate. If we go out, we go out by land. And I want that gate swinging wider and faster than a whorehouse door. Carlo, Galdo, you find us a wagon. Stash it behind the temple. Set it up with tarps and rope for fast packing.
Get us food and drink for the road. Simple stuff, sturdy stuff. Spare cloaks, plain clothing. You know what to do. If any right people spot you at work, maybe drop a hint that we're after a fat score in the next few days. Barsavi would like that, if it gets back to him. Bug, tomorrow you and I are going to go through the vault. We'll bring up every coin in there, and we're going to pack them in canvas sacks for easy transport. If we have to run, I want to be able to throw the whole mess on the back of our wagon in just a few minutes.
Makes sense, said Bug.
So, Sansas, you stick together, said Locke. Bug, you're with me. Nobody goes it alone for any length of time except Jean. You're the least likely to get troubled if the Grey King's got anything less than an army hidden in the city. Oh, you know me. Jean reached behind his neck, down behind the loose leather vest he wore over his simple cotton tunic. He withdrew a pair of matching hatchets, each a foot and a half in length, with leather-wrapped handles and straight black blades that narrowed like scalpels. These were balanced with balls of blackened steel, each as wide around as a silver solon. The Wicked Sisters, Jean's weapons of choice. I never travel alone. It's always the three of us. Right then, Locke yawned. If we need any other bright ideas, we can conjure them when we wake up. Let's set something heavy against the door, shut the windows, and start snoring. The gentleman bastards had just stumbled to their feet to begin putting this sensible plan into action when Jean held up one hand for silence. The stairs outside the door on the north wall of the chamber were creaking under the weight of many feet. A moment later, someone was banging on the door itself.
Lamora! Came a loud male voice. Open up! Copper's business!
Jean slipped his hatchets into one hand and put that hand behind his back, then stood against the north wall, a few feet to the right of the door. Carlo and Galdo reached under their shirts for their daggers, Galdo pushing Bug back behind him as they did so. Locke stood in the center of the room, remembering that his stilettos were still wrapped up in his fair white coat.
What's the price of a loaf? He shouted. At the shifting market!
One copper flat, but the loaves ain't dry, came the response.
Locke untensed just a bit. That was this week's proper greeting and countersign, and if they'd been coming to haul him off for anything bloody, well, they'd have simply kicked in the door. Signalling with his hands for everyone to stay calm, he drew out the bolt and slid the front door open just wide enough to peek out. There were four men on the platform outside his door, 70 feet in the air above the last mistake. The sky was the colour of murky canal water behind them, with just a few twinkling stars vanishing slowly here and there. They were hard-looking men, standing ready and easy like trained fighters, wearing leather tunics, leather collars, and red cloth bandanas under black leather caps. Red Hands, the gang Barsavi turned to when he needed muscle work, and he needed it fast.
Begging your pardon, brother.
The apparent leader of the Red Hands put one arm up against the door.
Big man wants to see Locke Lamora right this very moment, and he don't care what state he's in, and he won't let us take no for an answer.